this evening, it's a great pleasure to be able to welcome Dr. Horst Fellbeck. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about him. He is a professor here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And I've spent the last half hour trying to learn some German without much success. Though I have to say, Horst is a wonderful tutor. So I went away into a corner and tried to learn how to pronounce his university, where he did his PhD, and I'm going to try and pronounce it right now. Westfälische Wilhelms-Universität, Münster, Germany. And he came to Scripps Institution of Oceanography as a postdoc in 1979, and like so many of us who come to Scripps, he never left. He actually rapidly, in fact, in 1983, became an assistant professor and a full professor in 1998. And he researches really the interactions between bacteria and invertebrates. He's in fact a biochemist. He started his work on land, and then he became very interested, or he actually says it's by chance, but that he became interested in marine biology. I'm sure it was a lot more than chance that got him excited about interactions with bacterial symbiotes, particularly tube worms that you find in deep sea vents. And I'm very, very excited tonight to learn more about what he's going to talk to us about on deep sea vents. So without further ado, I'm going to ask Horst to come and talk to us. Thank you. I forgot the best bit, and that is I discovered an old interview that Horst gave, and what his main hobbies and interests were. And I think this will tell you a lot about him. His main hobby, he likes to motorcycle. His best, most favorite movies are Pretty Woman and Blade Runner. And his favorite book is Asterix.
Thanks, Nigella. And you did pronounce the Westfälische Wilhelms-Universität pretty well. I'm used to that people who want to introduce me in talks, I always have to coach what that really means. And the university is in Münster, and I always make a point saying that this town has nothing to do with the cheese. Well, in the meantime, I can tell you a little story. Nigella mentioned that I was not really a marine biologist when I was in Germany and got my PhD, but I'm a marine biologist by title, basically. When people come to me and show me a fish and tell, what fish is that? I have no idea. I can tell them what metabolic pathways they may have, but I don't recognize one from another. But that was a that sometimes leads to a quite peculiar situations. So I once was on a trip before a research day in Belize, and my student and I, we happened to be in a bar in the evening, and there was a government official there who was dealing with shrimp farming in Belize, and she made the mistake of telling him that I was a professor of marine biology. This guy jumped. And then he wanted to know everything from me about what they should do in Belize about shrimp farming. And I have no idea what this guy was talking about, or I had no idea about shrimp farming. So that's the title of my talk to today. And I just wanted to explain to you briefly how hydrothermal vents, you probably have heard about that sometimes from newspaper, plenty of publicity about these things, how they are formed. And the explanation is simple, that you have to imagine the surface of the Earth as these big plates moving. And where these plates move apart, you can imagine that there's a gap forming. And these gaps sometimes form at amazing speeds in geological terms, several inches per year. So that several inches per year where two plates move apart and there's nothing in between. So what happens here is that at the edges of the plates, the crust is very thin and the magma comes in pretty close contact, comes pretty high up. And since these borders are very often in the deep sea, the magma comes in very close contact with the seawater. So what happens there is that seawater, and here you can see some of these borders of the plates. Here, there's one right here offshore. So what happens there, where the crust is very thin, is that seawater seeps into the porous crust here. This is lava. And when lava cools down, it has a lot of cracks in it. So seawater can easily seep in here. And then it's heated up in the contact with the hot rocks down here. And upon that contact, the water is not only heated, but also a lot of chemical reactions happen. For example, the sulfate, which is in seawater, is reduced to sulfide. Sulfide is this foul-smelling gas all of you know, whether you know it or not. It's like rotten eggs. And then the hot water is ejected again here at these places. So the hot water rises and is ejected back into the seawater. The seawater has temperatures here at up to 400 degrees Celsius. The reason it's not boiling is that these areas are typically in the deep sea, and it's just like a pressure cooker, because the pressure is so high, 250 to 300 bar, that it keeps the hot water from boiling. So, at these hydrothermal vent areas, here another picture of places where plates move apart. At these places, one found animal communities like this. And these animal communities were, the existence of these animal communities were very surprising. The simple reason is that usually in the deep sea, there are animals, sure, but they are very rare. You see a fish once in a while, you see invertebrates in the mud, but concentrations like this have never been seen before. So how does this deep sea usually look like? That is very simple. It looks like that. That is basically the reason that there's not much life down there, because all the food for the normal life has to rain down from the surface. So dead animals, feces from the organisms on the surface, it all rains down. And then the animals at the bottom, which live close to the ocean bottom, they can eat that, and that's what they need to survive. So it came as a big surprise when these animal communities were found. In the following, I want to explain to you a little bit how one works with these areas, because obviously when you are in 2,500 meters depth, you cannot just simply go there and pick up a few animals and do experiments with them. So one needs submarines. You probably, most of you have heard about the submarine Alvin, which is the main workhorse in these areas, at least here in the Pacific. It can go down to these depths. It has two arms outside, so it can collect animals with these two arms and put them in a collection container. The three people sit inside this titanium ball, which is 6 feet diameter, and there's one pilot and two observers. So you spend about 7 to 8 hours in this ball. You go in the water in the morning and come back in the evening, and no, there's no bathroom. Because I always get that question. So one knows each other really well after a dive like that. So what happens then when after the animals come to the surface in a collection container like this, or typically an insulated collection container, we call it a worm coffin, because it's a thick walled basket with a lid, because the animals can withstand brief periods of atmospheric pressure. So when they come up, they don't have to be kept under pressure all the time, but they have to be kept cold. If for some reason the collection container doesn't close all the way and the surface water gets into the worm coffin, it really turns into a coffin, all the animals are dead when we want to collect them. So what we do with them, we bring them over to the lab ship, which we used at that time. This is the Atlantis with a submarine here in the back. And this is the boat which brings the animals in an ice chest over to the second ship. Then we put them in high-pressure aquaria because they can withstand atmospheric pressure only for a certain period of time, 2 to 3 hours. Then they die. So in these pressure aquaria, we kept them at in situ pressure of about 250 bar with running seawater. These are the pressure pumps here. They look rusty, yes, but that happens to the newest pumps after 2 or 3 weeks on sea and standing in seawater all the time. This is all stainless steel here, as you see. So the seawater can be conditioned with the right combination of chemicals and pH and oxygen content so that the animals live in these high-pressure aquaria. A colleague of mine, Jim Childress from Santa Barbara, was able to keep tube worms in one of those pressure chambers for almost 1 year. And then the tube worms unfortunately died because there was a big storm and the seawater inlet in Santa Barbara sucked in fresh water instead of salt water. That was the end of it. So when one wants to make experiments with the animals, one has to take them out. Then they need to get undressed, which means the tubes have to be removed from the worms. The worms just sit in the tubes loosely, but obviously they don't want to come out. So many people have different ways to get them out. She just turns them over and just holds them a while. After a while, they relax and slide out. Another person uses that approach. Not my favorite. But then in the lab, we can do experiments with the animals. We usually take tissue samples and do incubations or do bacterial preparations. This is the inside of a 20-foot container sitting on the fantail of the ship. And you need to imagine, outside is tropical temperature, so about 95 degrees. Inside the van, it's about 70. Then the previous picture, this one, was done inside a cold room, which had about 35 degrees Fahrenheit. So one switches a lot among the temperatures, and most of the people doing that have a severe cold at the end. So, how do these animals work? Why do they live there? Or how can they live there? And I just wanted to recall here these tube worms, because those are my favorites. And what happens here, I mentioned already that the tube worms have no digestive tract. So they need to eat something. They are big. They are about 4 feet, up to 4 feet tall. Without the tube, with the tube it's much longer, but they don't live in the entire tube. So the tube worms, 2 inches thick, no digestive tract. So what do they eat? And their whole body is filled with a tissue, which is shown here. It's called the trophosome. So this entire worm has a closed circulatory system with hemoglobin, these gill-like structures, the red plumes, and then the rest of the body is filled with this tissue and gonads. That's it. But this tissue keeps has the key to the nutritional abilities of these worms, because that's a scanning EM photo, and you see these balls here. And these balls are bacteria which live in the cells of this tissue. These bacteria are the key to the survival of these worms, because they are sulfur oxidizing bacteria. I mentioned already that the sulfate of the seawater, which is normal in seawater and always present, is reduced to sulfide, that's S2 minus, due to the contact with the hot rocks. So the water which comes out of these hot vents there contains very high concentration of sulfide. And even though sulfide stinks, it's very energy rich. And these bacteria are able to utilize the oxidation of that sulfide to finally sulfate, so basically the oxidation back to the original state, as an energy source. They are also able to fix carbon dioxide, which means they have an energy source, they can fix carbon dioxide into organic compounds, just like plants do, so which means they can survive using the energy which was made, created geothermally, and use the CO2 from the seawater to produce organic material. The problem with these bacteria is, however, and I get back to that later, that they have never been cultured. It's been known for 25 years that these bacteria are there, and many people have tried to culture them. Especially every beginning graduate student says, I want to do it. Okay, year later, can't do it. So we still don't know exactly why that is the case, why they cannot be cultured. Probably they lose something upon entering the cells, but I'll get back to that. So what happens here is that the sulfide from the seawater and the carbon dioxide and oxygen is taken up in the plume of the worms and transported through the vascular system to these bacteria in this trophosome tissue. The sulfide is then oxidized with the oxygen. Oxygen is abundant there, to sulfate, creating energy. This energy is used to fix carbon dioxide into organic molecules. What the bacteria do then is the major trick, benefit for the host. Because the bacteria excrete part of the organic material they create to the host. So that means that basically these worms have their own food-generating bacteria inside their cells of their trophosome tissue. They don't need to eat. The bacteria provide everything they require. But I mentioned oxygen here, and you may have read in publications or newspapers that this ecosystem around the hydrothermal vents is completely independent of the sun and could survive a nuclear winter forever because it doesn't need sunlight. That's baloney. Because I mentioned oxygen here. And in a typical food chain, the kind of food chain which was assumed the only food chain which exists on Earth is that sunlight creates organic material through photosynthetic processes. And then the cow goes and eats the grass, and the humans go and eat the cow. So that's a simple food chain, but it's all based basically on sunlight. Now these hydrothermal vents were found with these animals without digestive tract, and everybody got excited and said, oh great, that's no sunlight, independent, totally new food chain. Right, it is a totally new food chain, because the role of the photosynthetic organisms was taken by chemosynthetic organisms. But by all means, it's not independent of the outside of the Earth, because the oxygen which these organisms need to oxidize the sulfide ultimately is released by photosynthetic organisms. When they do photosynthesis, oxygen is released. That's how oxygen started to be on Earth. And that still happens. When photosynthesis is there, the oxygen is released. And that's the origin of all oxygen, aside of some very minor processes, radiolysis or some other things which can release some oxygen. But photosynthesis is by far the most important one. And that links these two systems. So the oxygen has to come from photosynthesis, which means if there is a sudden meteor impact on the surface of the Earth and all plant life dies out because there's no sun, they certainly will survive for a long time until they used up all the oxygen in the oceans. But not forever, because there's no way to replenish oxygen. So what are the key questions which we are trying to investigate in these tube worms and also some other symbioses which are based on the same principles? For example, mussels and clams and the hydrothermal vents have the same kind of symbionts, bacterial symbionts. They have them in the gills, in gill cells. Or in some other environments, we also found some symbiosis with these kinds of symbionts. So the key questions: nutrient acquisition. How do the worms get their nutrients? How do they incorporate carbon? How do they incorporate nitrogen? These are the main elements there. And then what's the nature of this association? So how do the bacteria and the worms find each other? How are they adapted to a symbiotic life? The fact that the worms have no digestive tract is very indicative that this symbiosis has been in place for a very long time, because it takes a while until one loses the digestive tract without a trace. Metabolic characteristics, what's happening there? Then symbiont transmission, how are the symbionts acquired? How are they, or are they, transmitted to the next generation? How do little baby tube worms acquire their symbionts, or are they already there? And then one wants to find out the requirements for culturing of the symbionts. That would be a very important step if somebody would be able to do that, because then you can finally do experiments with bacteria in a culture flask instead of having to collect the worms, purifying the bacteria, taking them out, and then doing experiments with dying bacteria. So the one of the questions, the metabolic characteristics and the carbon incorporation, was done. This is a photo from Monica Bright from Vienna. This is a crosscut across a baby tube worm. This here is the trophosome, the tissue containing the bacteria. And what she did is she incubated these baby tube worms in the presence of radiolabeled carbon dioxide. Then after a while, she took them out and fixed them and acidified it. So all the non-fixed carbon dioxide was released as gas. What stayed behind was the carbon dioxide, which was fixed into non-volatile compounds. Then she did autoradiography, which means she took a slice of these tube worms and put them on film and looked where the film is blackened from the radioactivity. Then one can overlay this photo with that and see where the radioactivity is. And you can see clearly here that all the radioactivity, which in this case is fixed carbon dioxide, so carbon dioxide which is fixed into organic compounds, is all in the trophosome where the bacteria are. here on the outside, where the body wall is, there's only a very small amount of fixed carbon dioxide. The bulk is in here, which means that was the proof that they really indeed do use these bacteria to fix carbon dioxide. Another possibility to do research with these worms is, since one cannot culture the bacteria, one can just purify them from the trophosome. The bacterial quantities in this trophosome are tremendous, up to the 10 to the 12 per gram. So that's a much higher quantity than microbiologists ever get in any cultures. One can just take a piece of trophosome, grind it up carefully and gently, and release the symbionts, and then put them on a gradient centrifugation, and these are the symbionts. It takes about half an hour. One gets good quantities of these symbionts with these preparations. Then one can do all kinds of experiments with them. For example, one can extract the DNA. Once one has the DNA, one can look for individual genes. One can go and attempt to sequence the DNA. And Terry Gasterland is here. She's dealing with that mainly, with finding out what these genes in the sequence mean. Or one can do, one can pick out individual genes and do something with them. For example, a graduate student at Scripps transferred these genes into E. coli. That's a normal bacterium, which is basically the white rat of the microbiologists. And this bacterium had a mutation that it didn't have a flagellum. The flagellums are these threads which are coming out of the bacterium, which they use to for movement. And one could transfer a gene assembly from the tube-borne bacteria into these E. coli, which originally don't have a flagellum, and they suddenly grow a flagellum. So this flagellum is from this bacteria in the tube worms, in the trophosome. One can do experiments to find out what these bacteria excrete to the tube worms, because it's very important to know what kind of substances do they transfer. We know they fix carbon dioxide into organic material, but then what do they transfer? And a simple experiment is, for example, you make a suspension of purified bacteria, put labeled carbon dioxide into this suspension. After a while, the incubation period, you spin the bacteria down and you look what is labeled in the supernatant and in the bacteria. What is in the supernatant is the compound which the bacteria excrete. What is in the bacteria is what they keep to themselves. Of course, one can argue that the label in the supernatant is due to breaking up bacteria. But if the labeling pattern, so if the compounds labeled in the bacteria are different than the compounds labeled in the supernatant, then this is a proof that this is really not due to breaking bacteria, but these are really excreted. And it was found that indeed the bacteria excrete an amino acid, glutamate, and an organic acid, malic acid, into the supernatant. We don't know for sure whether inside the cell they will do the same, because obviously the environment inside the cell is very different than the environment here. Another way to look at the characteristics of the bacteria is to take again the purified bacteria and to look at the proteins. This is a tube worm symbiont. What happens here, or what was done here, that the proteins were extracted from the symbionts and were run on a gel to separate them. You may want to count, but let me assure you that these are about 500 different spots here. So these are 500 different proteins, which then can be extracted from this kind of gel and identify it individually to find out what proteins the symbionts have. And because one can compare that to known data about the genomic makeup of the symbionts, one can then find out what these proteins are, what enzymes they are, and therefore what the tube worms may be doing metabolically. I want to mention briefly before I end that this symbiosis was discovered in the hydrothermal vents. The main reason for that was that at the hydrothermal vents there were these weird tube worms with no digestive tract. So one was basically prepared for anything unusual. And one looked for something which was not known or unheard of or, in parentheses, impossible. After this kind of symbiosis was discovered at this exotic site, hydrothermal vents, many more sites were found, or many more examples have been found, where this kind of symbiosis plays a significant role for the nutrition of normal animals. For example, this here is a mussel which is found, which was found initially off the coast of Louisiana. They have symbionts in their gills which are oxidizing methane instead of sulfide as an energy source. Where these mussels live, you may have seen pictures, the oil drilling platforms, and if you go down with a submarine, you see the methane gas bubbling out of the ground. So they use that methane gas to produce energy for themselves, to fix carbon dioxide. These bivalves were collected in the Los Angeles sewage. And I talked to John Boas here earlier. He accompanied us on quite a few cruises to collect these. You stand up to your knees in sewage sludge, and it's not pleasant. You pick out peas and hair and band-aids, and the mussels are in between. But these bivalves are the only major animal living there. They also have symbionts in their gills. These symbionts oxidize sulfide. In this case, the sulfide, however, is not produced geothermally, like at the hydrothermal vents, but through the bacteria in the sewage sludge. This here is a clam which lives in the Santa Barbara Basin. Santa Barbara Basin is anoxic, therefore produces sulfide, and they live at the interface of the anoxic sulfide basin and the oxic overlying waters. They also have these symbionts. That's my favorite spot. There are worms, tiny worms, really tiny. They are about hair thick and about half a millimeter long, or 2 millimeters long. And you have to pick them between the sand grains by hand under a microscope. And once you have collected about 1,000 of them, it takes you about 2 seconds to grind them up, and that's enough for one time point. So it is very frustrating. But as you can see, it has its advantages to be there. And I've been there twice for 4 weeks each. It was very pleasant, but it resulted in quite some good results also. What does it all mean? Why do we do that? And especially recently, went through the newspapers a lot, these strange environments on moons of Jupiter, and just recently, a few weeks ago, on the moon of Saturn, where apparently the moon is covered by ice, water ice, apparently, and it is thought or hoped or expected that there's some liquid water under the ice, because, for example, on the Jupiter moon Europa, it is known that this moon creates heat in itself. There's ice on top of it. So one could expect that there's a layer of liquid water in between the ice and the warm rocks. That's where possibly hydrothermal vents can be. And of course, that's an artist's depiction, but that's how one hopes it looks like. The problem is to get there and to get through an ice layer which is expected to be several hundred miles thick. But there are already plans, have some radioisotope in a drill which slowly sinks down and basically gets through the ice by melting the ice around it, and gravity pulls it down. Okay, that's all I wanted to say. Thanks for coming. The question is what the material is, what the tubes are made of. It's a mixture of chitin, like you know from insects, and protein. The tubes have the consistency of basically fingernails, soft fingernails after a long bath. And when they dry, they turn into a hard substance.
What atoll was that?
Pardon me?
Which island in the Pacific?
That was Caribou Key, that is off the coast of Belize. Well, we did not know at that point whether they ever have a digestive tract, but I happen to have a slide. Let me see, what there. This is it turns out that the tube worms do have a digestive tract when they are very young adults, right after settling of the larvae. This is a tube worm which is about 3 millimeters, this is 400 micrometers, so about 2 millimeters long. And this tube worm still has a digestive tract. And it even has a mouth. This little structure here, if you enlarge it further, you see the hole here? That's a mouth. The tube worms lose that very soon after that state. So in the beginning, we only knew that they did not have a digestive tract without knowing when they lost it or how and what happened. But it turns out that they lose it during their during growing, after they settle as larvae. The tube worms have two sexes. They are males and females, and one can distinguish them from outside. The eggs and sperm have been observed to be released into the seawater, and they probably fertilize them then. There are other reports that there may be internal fertilization, but we don't really know that. These tube worms are attached to the ground, so I see some problems. The larvae then are free floating and are carried away by the currents. After a while, something causes them to settle. They may be attracted by sulfide, for example, from another vent. You need to remember that these vents are sometimes miles or sometimes even many miles apart from each other. So when the larvae are released on one vent, when a vent field is at the most as big as this room here, and the next one is 20 miles away, maybe 20 miles away. So the larvae need to get there. The currents can do that. The larvae do not require much metabolic energy while they are just drifting. And then the larvae settle and grow into adult tube worms. This here is a larvae. You see the digestive tract here? They can still eat.
Do they have the symbionts at that stage?
At that stage, as a larvae, they do not have the symbionts yet. So the question was, do they have symbionts at that stage? At that stage, they do not have symbionts yet, but may acquire them during that stage, short before they settle. There are two theories at the moment how they acquire the symbionts. One is, I showed this picture with a snout, with an open mouth, that the symbionts go through that mouth and stay in the gut and then later populate the cells which turn into trophosome. Quite recently, a new theory has been put forward, and that will be published shortly in Science, that the symbionts migrate through the body wall of the larvae and enter the cells. We need to see what can be proven and what comes out as the right theory. We don't know yet. The question is how the tubes are created. The tubes are excreted by the body wall of the tube worms. If you take a tube worm out of the tube and put them in a replacement tube, for example, you can just roll a piece of plastic or paper, close it at the bottom, put the tube worm in there, they start creating new layers of tube on the inside of that artificial housing. So they create their tubes in layers, thin layers. It's the tube of the adults is made from many, many very thin layers. They can move in their tubes. They can put cross walls also. We don't know how they do that. But they are, the body wall has glands which can excrete that material which makes up the tube. The question was whether there's any chance to acclimate the tube worms to one atmosphere. We tried that many times because it would make it a lot cheaper to do that research, and NSF would love us for it. But unfortunately, it doesn't work. We had tried them to bring them up to atmospheric pressure very slowly over a matter of many days, and they still die if one does that, even if one keeps them cold. The question was how the energy of the bacteria is different from ATP. It's not different. The energy of the bacteria is also ATP. The bacteria have ATP, and that is the main common energy transfer molecule. But they do not excrete it. The bacteria have their individual energy metabolism, and they create the organic material. They have NADH, ATP, NADPH, and all these abbreviations. But what they excrete to the tube worms is organic material. And then the tube worms are normal heterotrophic organisms. So they break down the organic material just like you and I do and create energy for themselves from that organic material. So the ATP stays in the bacteria and is not transferred to the host. Did that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
First, thank you very much. It was a wonderful